Okay, we're on chapter 21. David then went his way, and Jonathan returned to the town. So if you look at that in the Hebrew, it says, Vayakam Vayelach, which means he got up and he went. And then Vihonatan Ba, which meant comes or went, Ha'ir, to the city. And so it's a pretty good translation in terms of suggesting that David goes off where David wants and Jonathan goes to the conventional place, back to the city. And there is this sense in which, you know, David is, in which David is always going his own way. In one of the, you know, I'm reading obviously about David in the off season, that is in between classes too. And in one of the books, which is written, by the way, there's a biography of David by Jonathan Kirsch, the guy who does the book reviews for the Jewish Journal, wonderful guy. And in it, he has a quote from Harold Bloom, the literary critic, talking about the fact that David charmed everyone, even God. And there is something to, yeah, it's very, he doesn't put it exactly that way, but that's the... So David goes his own way, and Jonathan returns to the city, and David now has succeeded in making Jonathan both a conquest and a protector. So David goes to the priest Ahimelech at Nov. Ahimelech came out in alarm to meet David, and he said, why are you alone and no one with you? Not a good thing for somebody who's the heir apparent to the kingship to be traveling alone, and probably not someone who's bringing good news. David answered the priest Ahimelech, the king has ordered me on a mission. Now there's another way of putting what this is. We would call this a lie. David is clearly lying. King sent him on no mission whatsoever, but it is permissible after all, since he's trying to save his life. And for all that we get down on David, the truth is, I mean, he's a young man who's being pursued by the king of Israel and his troops. So you have to give him a lot of latitude for virtually any stratagem that he comes up with that allows him to survive. And also the other part of this is that although David is clearly a person of faith, as is, I mean, virtually everyone in the ancient world, but I think especially David, and feels touched by God's grace in some significant way since he walks from triumph to triumph, he's wise enough not to depend on that alone. You know, he doesn't just say, oh, God's going to protect me, I don't have to worry about it. So he gives God a helping hand by being clever. No one must know anything about the mission on which I am sending you and for which I have given you orders. Now, this also lets you know that David already has sufficient stature that he can tell a priest that he's sending him on a private mission from the king, and the priest will believe him. Because he can't just be some schmo who works in the palace and, you know, and tells a priest what to do. He obviously is well known and trusted. So I've directed my young men to such and such a place. Now then, what have you on hand? Any loaves of bread? Since those were, you know, often they were used in the temple, just like you have two chalot, the two challahs that you have on Friday night, those two loaves of bread are parallel to the two loaves of bread that are in the temple, because your Friday night dinner table is supposed to be like the altar. Okay? That's why you have salt, because salt was used on the sacrifice, and that's why you have two loaves of bread. Same thing. I don't need to make a joke out of it when I say the rabbis took eating seriously. They took the idea of a table very seriously, of a home table. They talk about that, you know, if you sit around at a meal and you don't discuss Torah, then the meal is wasted and your table is like a tabernacle and all of that. So they reenacted on Shabbat what goes on in the temple. So let me have them or whatever is available. The priest answered David, I have no ordinary bread on hand. There's only consecrated bread. That is bread that was going to be used in the sacrifice, provided the young men have kept away from women. In other words, assuming it's still consecrated and there haven't been any defilements gone on in the temple. Now, I know it shocks you that defilements are this ancient, but but it shouldn't. In reply to the priest, David said, I assure you that women have been kept from us, as always. Whenever I went on a mission, even if the journey was a common one, in other words, he can eat the consecrated bread because he hasn't had sex, because if he's had sex, he would have to cleanse himself in a mikveh or something else in order to purify himself to be ready for to eat consecrated bread. Even if the journey was a common one, the vessels of the young men were consecrated. All the more then may consecrated food be put into their vessels today. The idea of sex as defilement, this is a big, I mean, the problem is, first of all, the English word defilement is not a good word. There are lots of laws in Judaism about purity. And purity is an idea that doesn't exist in modern American society. And because it doesn't exist, we tend to conflate it with good and bad, or with right and wrong, or with sin and virtue. And it's not. It's a separate realm, the realm of purity. And it has nothing to do with right or wrong, but it does have to do with whether you can be fully in the service of God or not. So, for example, there's nothing wrong with a Kohen walking in a graveyard, but since a corpse is tum'ah, is impure, if he does, and the temple's built tomorrow, he can't serve in the temple. That's the issue, okay? So it's too bad in some ways that defilement is such a negative term, but that's basically what he's saying, is he still exists in the state of purity that would allow him to eat from consecrated stuff. And if you ask, by the way, There's no agreement among scholars what constitutes purity or impurity. But if I have to make a vast, unsupported generalization, which I don't have to, but I will, it's largely the things that remind human beings of their essential physicality make them impure. That's why a corpse is av tuma, which means the father of impurity, because a corpse is just the physical body, completely removed from the spirit. So it's the most impure. Sexuality, a woman's menstrual period, a corpse, all these things remind people that they're bodies. And so there's something about that, as opposed to spirit, that's not captured well by the category of good and bad. Because remember that ultimately Judaism teaches that there'll be a resurrection, which means that you come back with a body. So a body can't be bad if at the end of days you end up with a body, but it is impure. So anyway, look, we could spend a long time on this, and I'm not sure we'd come to any deeper understanding, but at least that's, you know. Okay, so the priest gave him consecrated bread. What this amounts to is he needed to get food. He's on the run, this is one of those times where it's useful to think about what the world is like in that time. It's not like he can stop in a store. He's got to pick fruit from the trees and stop in the local temple, because there is no temple at the time. Remember, there are only local temples. There's no central temple because it hasn't been built yet. So there are local shrines, and the priests get offerings from people at those shrines, and that's how they have food.
Everything is kosher.
Everything's kosher, sure. Absolutely. Glot kosher, which is the biggest... forget it. Do you know what glot means? Glot means smooth. It refers to the lungs of the animal. Okay? That's what it means. In other words, there's nothing in the animal that is any hint of disease which could render it unkosher. So glot of anything other than a slaughtered animal doesn't make any sense. You can't have a glot kosher dairy restaurant. It's ridiculous, because there's no such thing as glot kosher cheese. But it just means, it's just part of this impulse to make things more and more and more, and therefore to assure people that they're really, it's like my late teacher, Eliezer Shlomovic, said to me, he came back from B'nai Brak, where his relatives live, which is an ultra, ultra Orthodox community. And he said, every time I go there, they're paying more for vegetables, because there has to be an additional rabbi's stamp on it, an additional rabbi stamp. And like, it's like broccoli, for example, which now you can't get in some kosher restaurants, even though a generation ago, every Jew ate broccoli, but then someone discovered that in fact there are small bugs in the broccoli that are impossible or at least very difficult to get out. So we invented a new, what's called chumra, a new stringency. Blackberries too, anything that's, you know, that has folds that make it difficult to, anyway, which is, by the way, which may be uncomfortable for us to think about how much you actually eat when you eat a salad, but that's a separate, just now that I've told you, please forget it. Anyway, so the priest gave him consecrated bread because there was none there except the bread of display, that is the bread that's used for the sacrifice, which had been removed from the presence of the Lord to be replaced by warm bread as soon as it was taken away. In other words, they I think that verse is in there to show you that they didn't sacrifice anything essential. That is, they had other bread. So they could give bread to him and they could replace it with warm bread. And it's not like David was taking something that the temple couldn't afford to give him. Now, one of Saul's officials was there that day, detained before the Lord, and which is a curious phrase. They interpret it here as excluded from the shrine, perhaps because of ritual impurity. And his name was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief herdsman. So I guess that the king, or at least Saul individually, had somebody who functioned as, you know, taking care of his flock. David said to Ahimelech, haven't you got a sword or a spear or a sword on hand? I didn't take my sword or any of my weapons with me because the king's mission was urgent. Again, you know. Yes, although it also reminds you the fact that he thinks that there's a sword or a spear in a shrine tells you that it's the ancient world, you know, and every household has a gun because not only, by the way, for defense against people, but also defense against animals. This is a world in which wild animals roved too, after all. That's why you had shepherds, and that's why, remember, David says that I killed a lion and I killed a bear because this was an untamed world. It's one of the reasons why I've mentioned before, I think, that the Talmud says that it's an obligation of a parent to teach their child how to swim. Because there are holes all over the game, and when it rains, they're filled with water, and kids used to drown if they would fall into a hole, which, you know, is what kids do. the priest said, there is the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you slew in the valley of Elah. It's over there, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want to take that one, take it, for there is none here but that one. David said, there is none like it, give it to me. Now, very obviously very symbolic that David is going to defend himself with Goliath's sword, and also that the sword is at a shrine, which means that it has deep significance to people, right, that it would be there. It's probably sort of on display, although it's wrapped up in a cloth, and also that David didn't keep it, that he donated it, so to speak. So that day, David continued on his flight from Saul, and he came to King Achish of Gath. The courtiers of Achish said to him, why, that's David, king of the land. So obviously, there's a substantial number of people who already start to think of David as the king. And that being the case, you get in this chapter, almost inadvertently, not quite inadvertently, the division that's going on in David's life. He comes to Ahimelech and says, the king has sent me on a mission, but then he goes out and other people think he's the king. So he's in that in-between state. And the scholars refer to this, what we're still in, this beginning part of David's story, because it's really still the beginning part of David's story, as the succession narrative. That is basically the story of how David became king. And what you see here is that we're sort of in the middle of his, I mean, once Saul dies, it's all over, but Saul doesn't die till the end of the book, the end of the first book. But you can see that he is thought of as king of many, even though not the official king foremost. That's the one of whom they sing as they dance. Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. So now, David isn't safe in Israel, and he needs somewhere to flee to. And the only other substantial people are the Philistines. So that explains why David is now plotting to run away to the only place that he can think of where there aren't people who want to kill him, which is the Philistines who lived in Gaza, by the way. That's where the Philistines, they were a seafaring people of the Bronze Age, and they lived in Gaza, where they originally came from, maybe also from Egypt, not clear, but anyway, so that's where he wants to go. He basically wants to take refuge among the enemies because it's safer than being in Israel, where Saul is still king, and where you saw from that little slip that they put in, not slip, but that little hint they put in about Doeg the Edomite, there's nowhere he can go that there isn't someone of Saul's house that could always prove to be the person who kills him. These words worried David, and he became very much afraid of King Achish of Gath, Gath being in Gaza, because if Achish thinks that he's Israel's great hero, then the first thing he's going to do is kill him, right? If he's the king of Israel, then that's a pretty formidable scalp for Achish to claim. And so he's now afraid, even though he has to go to the Philistines, of what the Philistines are going to do to him. So he concealed his good sense from them. He feigned madness for their benefit. Okay? So what does this remind you of? Those of you who know Hamlet, he does the same thing, right? He does the same thing. And to what extent, by the way, Shakespeare was influenced by this is hard to know. But here is the prince, the heir apparent to the throne, who fears for his life and feigns madness. Very Hamlet-y. It's a different story, obviously, than David, but it has elements that are the same. And what he does is he scratched marks on the door of the gate and let his saliva run down his beard. It's an extraordinary thing to think about. And if you've never read the story of David, and I told you that David had to feign madness it's so much more human than, and so much more real, and feels so much more documentary than the earlier parts of the Torah, even the most powerful stories about Abraham and Isaac and Moses. They never have this human quality of this is how David pretended he was crazy so that the Philistines wouldn't kill him. And he's scratching on the door and he's letting saliva run down his beard. And the thing about madness in part is that it's a natural human repellent. You don't want to get close to people who seem crazy. You want to just leave them alone and stay far away from them. That's why, I don't know if you saw that remarkable photo of that went viral on the internet of the policeman in New York and the homeless guy. Oh, it's a great picture. Apparently this policeman in New York saw this homeless guy whose feet were bare. He went out, got him boots, brought back and was about to put boots on him when a tourist who happened to come by snapped the photo and put it on his Facebook page or on the internet, and it's gotten a couple of million hits. And now he's become this hero. There was a big picture of him in the New York Times this morning and so on. But in part, not just because of the act of compassion, but because the normal impulse, if you see the guy who's the homeless guy is clearly like unwashed and unsavory. It's like somebody that you wouldn't want to go near. And here he is being a human being instead of acting the way human beings normally act. This is not so different, is that David is making himself repellent deliberately so that he won't be worth killing. And Achish said to his courtiers, "You see the man is raving. Why bring him to me? Do I lack madmen that you've brought this fellow to rave for me? Should this fellow enter my house?" I don't have enough crazy people among the Philistines. I need their crazies too. It's extraordinary that I want to almost say that David is gifted even in this, which tells you that among his abilities is the ability to act in both senses, both to act, that is, in terms of action, and also to act like an actor, the way that the occasion demands. And part of the purpose of the story, I have no doubt, is just to give you, again, a sense of the enormous range of gifts of this man. This is just an earthquake. Not a big deal. Okay, so let's stop there for a minute. Questions? Yeah.
Goliath's sword must have been humongous.
Yes, but it's the only sword there. It's the only one there, so he has to use it.
How could he?
He doesn't have a choice. He's got no other sword.
He couldn't lift it up.
He's got no. I mean, he could lift it. He probably can't swing it as quickly as he can swing a shorter sword, but he has no choice. If you the only at bats is Babe Ruth's bat, so you take it. You know, you may not be able to hit a fastball, but at least you have a bat in your hand. Yeah.
Why wouldn't the Philistines have taken out their revenge on David for killing Goliath?
Because he was crazy. I guess that's why. I mean, that's the only explanation that we can. But don't forget, he's also carrying Goliath's sword, so it is a little implausible unless he hid it somewhere when he went to act crazy.
But if he was carrying the Goliath sword,
right?
Surely.
I said unless he hid it somewhere when he went in to act crazy. But that's the only explanation that we can. There's another explanation, but you won't like it, not you, which is that in the Book of Chronicles, which is the story of David rewritten, right? I haven't talked much about the Book of Chronicles because it's basically the story of David rewritten with all the parts of David that we don't like taken out. It's David sanitized, okay? Basically. It isn't David who kills Goliath. It's another name, which escapes me for the moment. So the other possibility is that that's not actually what happened, but assuming that it is what happened, then I guess they just think he's nuts. Yeah.
I have a general question. An historian writes events, but who writes, who records these conversations? This is something that is a general question about anything that we talk about. Who has these conversations that writes it?
The short answer is it is impossible to know. The slightly longer answer is most classical scholars assume that since in some way or another this is written by God, so God knows what you said. Modern scholars assume this is written by a writer they call the Deuteronomic historian. That is the one who wrote the story of the book of Deuteronomy and what follows and was centered around David and David's kingship. So these stories came down for generations because they assumed that he wrote this 150, 200 years after David died. So when you write a history, you reconstruct conversations. Thucydides did it in Greece. Herodotus did it in Greece. The ancient historian did it in Israel. So, but, yeah.
The concluding sentence is, what do I need more crazy people around me?
Right.
Why would he let him?
Why would who let him in?
Kid the king.
He didn't let him in. Oh, he was brought. He was brought into him clearly, and he said, "Take him away. I don't need him. Don't need him." Yeah.
Considering what's about to follow.
What's that? I can't hear you.
Considering what's about to follow in the next part of the story, no matter what David did, he's saying craziness. Was he not worried about spies and being overheard, and he's taking his life in his hands?
He is, but there's no place he can go that his life isn't being taken in his hand, because in Israel too. He's worried, but I think he probably thinks he's safer with the Philistines than he is with the Israelites, at least at the moment, which is, you know, a pretty damning, right, exactly. But at least the king of the Philistines is not committed to his murder, and the king of the Israelites is. So, and also, my guess here, although I don't know this for sure, but what you... This is completely a guess. But what you get the sense of is that the situation between peoples was fluid. That is, it's not like they said, oh my God, I can't believe an Israelite came over to the Philistines. So it must be that sometimes, you know, people would go back and forth, and also that it wasn't always so easy to tell who was who. It's not like everybody wore jerseys and I mean, they may have dressed a little bit differently, but there was probably the sharp divisions may not have been so sharp at the moment, since it's a tribal society. But whatever the it may also just be, and here I'd have to look at the route that they think that David took. It may be that he had to cross through Philistine territory to get to where he needed to go, because maybe he didn't want to pass through a particular stronghold of Saul's, you know, or of the tribe of Benjamin, who were the ones that Saul which was Saul's home tribe. Anyway, okay, I'll leave it at that. So David departed from there, let's do a little bit more, and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Caves obviously being safe places to hide generally. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard, they joined him down there. So presumably David sends a runner back to his father's house and says, I'm here, and there, you know, they come to support him. And then this, by the way, I just read this. Lincoln quoted this verse. Everyone who is in straits and everyone who is in debt and everyone who is desperate joined him. And I'm trying to remember the exact context, but it was, it was during the Civil War, but he quotes that in terms of, you know, the people who are desperate and who are needy and so on join this cause. But it's a nice, I'll see if I can find out where he quoted it. But anyway, the point is that David now has a ragtag army of people who are dissatisfied for one reason or another with the status quo, which is where you have to recruit your army if you're not the king or you want to be the king. It's the same thing, by the way, that Avshalom does to David later. Avshalom being David's son who rebels against him. And he goes out and he finds all the disaffected people and all the unhappy people and all the people who feel that they've been ill-treated by the king, and he gets them to his side in order to rebel, and David does the same. And he became their leader. There were about 400 men with him. Now let's assume for a moment, because this is, again, much more realistic numbers than the numbers that you get in the Torah, 400 people. I mean, it's nothing. It's nothing. If you think about it, right? That's fewer than there are kids in the school here in this one building. So you're talking about just a very small group, okay? And they're his ragtag army, and they're around him. And so you can imagine the scale of warfare is really very small, right? But also they're gonna, I mean, when you have 400 people around you in the ancient world in Israel, that also means that you're probably not gonna be easily assassinated. Right? It's going to take a war to assassinate you, not a single spy. David went from there to Mizpeh of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, let my father and mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me. So Moab now, what's the implicit bargain here? It is, you do me a favor, I have a good chance to be king, I will be indebted to you for taking care of my father and mother, and don't forget that the head of Moab is not thinking now, oh my God, he's going to come back and destroy my kingdom. He's playing a political calculus like anyone else. There are alliances between countries, because we tend to think of it as, okay, Israel exists like this, and Moab is just this part that has to be wiped out in order for there to be an Israel. But Moab is thinking of himself as a separate entity, like a separate country, and this guy's going to take over the Israel part of the country. And if he does, and he has good relations, and Moab has done him a favor, it's going to redound to the benefit of Moab. So he does. He led them to the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David remained in the stronghold. But the prophet God said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Go at once to the territory of Judah. So David left and went to the forest of Chereth. Now, the function of prophets, which is a really, I mean, it's crucial in the Torah, but you have to always ask yourself, how much does David get the military advice that he believes is accurate, and how much does he actually listen to what the prophet says to him, even in contradiction to what it is that he would otherwise believe? And it's very hard to know, but throughout David and all the kings, kingships in Israel, they consult prophets, and later the Urim v'Tumim, the breastplate of the priest, that, you know, you sort of some kind, it's almost like throwing dice that come up a certain way and give you an answer. So And also, it's not as though you just have one prophet. Generally, there are a few prophets or prophets working in bands or in groups. When Saul heard that David and the men with him had been located, Saul was then in Gibeah, sitting under a tamarisk tree on the height, spear in hand, with all his courtiers in attendance upon him. Saul said to the courtiers standing about him, "Listen, men of Benjamin." Remember, that's his tribe. So those are the people he trusts. He's got his homies with him and his spear in hand. Will the son of Jesse give fields and vineyards to every one of you? And will he make all of you captain of thousands or captains of hundreds? Is that why all of you have conspired against me? For no one informs me when my own son makes a pact with the son of Jesse. No one's concerned for me, and no one informs me when my own son has set my servant in ambush against me, as is now the case. So he's both telling them, you know, what is it, David bribed you? Because I'm going to give you more than David. And second, why doesn't anybody tell me that Jonathan, obviously someone told him or he wouldn't know, but that Jonathan has made a pact against me. So now he reappears, Doeg the Edomite. Remember, just a moment ago we saw him. He was there when David came to Ahimelech the priest and said, you know, give me something to eat. So Doeg reappears, who was standing among the courtiers of Saul, spoke up. I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub at Nov. He inquired of the Lord on his behalf and gave him provisions. He also gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Now, this was a fatal moment in Saul's history and a tragic one, because Saul is incapable of he's so blinded by hatred and fear of David that he's incapable of acting appropriately when he hears information like this, as you will see. Thereupon, the king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and all the priests belonging to his father's house at Nob. They all came to the king, and Saul said, "Listen to me, son of Ahitub." "Yes, my lord," he replied. When Saul wants to imply contempt, he says "son of." Right? He called David son of Jesse. He's calling the priest son of Ahitub. And Saul said to him, "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me? You gave him food and a sword and inquired of God for him, now that he may rise in ambush against me, as is now the case." Ahimelech replied to the king, "But who is there among your courtiers as trusted as David, son-in-law of your majesty, and obedient to your bidding and esteemed in your household? This is the first time I inquired of the Lord for him. I've done no wrong. Let not your majesty find fault with his servant or with any of your father's house, for your servant knew nothing whatever about all of this." Now, that's a very reasonable plea, and I think you believe it based on the fact that Ahimelech believed that he was sent on a mission from Saul. He's clearly innocent, and you're supposed to know that he's innocent, and now you're supposed to see what Saul does. But the king said, "You shall die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." And the king commanded the guard standing by, "Turn about and kill the priests of the Lord, for they're in league with David. They knew he was running away and didn't inform me." But the king's servant wouldn't raise a hand to strike down the priests of the Lord. Good for them. Thereupon the king said to Doeg, "You, Doeg, go and strike down the priests." And Doeg the Edomite went and struck down the priests himself. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He put Nob, the town of the priest, to the sword, men and women, children and infant, oxen, asses, and sheep, all to the sword. Now, first of all, I want to point out, Doeg is specifically identified as an Edomite. He's not an Israelite. So the Israelites don't want to kill the priests because those are their priests, but to Doeg, they don't have any particular religious significance. They're the priests of another tradition, but it also lets you know, again, just like Uriah the Hittite, who is married to Bathsheba, Doeg the Edomite is serving Saul, and you see that there's a mixture of tribes. It's not so clear, and that Saul might trust his own people from Benjamin and the Edomite more than he trusts another Israelite tribe, right? It's very possible that he does, because alliances are shifty, and you might trust a French Jew more than you trust a Nebraskan non-Jew. Or you might trust a Nebraskan American in a foreign country more than you trust a Jew from that country, because you share a culture with one more than with the other. You never know. So he might feel closer in some ways to the Edomite than he does to the tribe of Israel that's not his tribe, in the midst of what is a civil war. because it is a civil war, right? But one son of Ahimelech, son of Achitub, escaped. There's always got to be one, because somebody's got to bring the news. It's just like Job. The story of Job is the same thing, where all of them, there's a huge, they're always, Job has a succession of catastrophes. He loses his cattle, he loses his servants, and he loses his children. Each time, one escapes to run and tell Job the news, right? So to ensure maximum pain. Everybody dies except the one person who has to tell you that everybody died. So one son of Ahimelech, son of Achitub, escaped. His name was Abiathar, and he fled to David. When Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord, David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would tell Saul. I'm to blame for the deaths in your father's house. Stay with me. Do not be afraid. For whoever seeks your life must seek my life also. It will be my care to guard you." So David blames himself because he saw Doeg there, and he knew somewhere inside him that Doeg was going to tell Saul, but he didn't do anything about it, and he used the priests, and now he sees the consequence of what happened for using him. So here again, you see another side of David, which is that he understands that the consequences of his leadership are dire. They just are. I mean, it's going to be, and of course, as we'll see, he's going to precipitate, he already has sort of precipitated a civil war, but everybody that helps him, if Saul knows about it, is going to forfeit their life. Although it's not, I'm not sure that David could have imagined that Saul would take such drastic action, but maybe he could. Because remember, the reason that Saul kills the priests is not only because he's angry at the priests. He kills the priests so that no other priestly house will help David. This is a struggle to the death, and every one who helps your enemy is an enemy. So one of the ways that you make sure that people don't help is to let them know what the consequences of helping are. And that's reality. Okay, questions about chapter 22, since we're making some progress? No? Okay, so then let's move on to chapter 23. We can always review. David was told, "The Philistines are raiding Keilah and plundering the threshing floors. David consulted the Lord, 'Shall I go and attack those Philistines?'" Now, that might sound almost comical. He said, you know, should I? But the point is, he's asking, will I be successful? Will I die in this war? Should I fight this war? And the Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines, and you will save Keilah." Now, you're going to ask me, if you're not going to ask me, at least you're going to wonder, how does David know that God told him this? According to the Jewish tradition, prophecy comes to people in different ways. First of all, as I said, the Urim V'Tumim. Second, in dreams. According to the rabbis, Moses was the only one who had a sort of direct face-to-face communication with God. Other prophets don't have that. But I think it may also be true that what we think of as conscience or good judgment was also thought of as the voice of God. So that if David evaluates the situation and has a strong feeling that he can be successful, that he's going to interpret that as God telling him that he can be successful. And so it's not entirely cynical to say that God usually gives good advice to the people who are talented. You know, it's also that he interprets that gift as God's gift. But David's men said to him, "Look, we're afraid here in Judah. How much more if we go to Keilah against the forces of the Philistines?" So David consulted the Lord again. He wanted to make sure. He checked his judgment, just good leadership. And the Lord answered him, "March down at once to Keilah, for I'm going to deliver the Philistines into your hands." David and his men went to Keilah and fought against the Philistines. He drove off their cattle and inflicted a severe defeat upon them. Thus David saved the inhabitants of Keilah, which means that he has now won the loyalty of another town. When Avyatar, son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah, he brought down an ephod with him. An ephod are, again, the stones of the priests, and that will enable David to consult the ephod, and it is a benefit of having saved, of having befriended, rather, Avyatar. But when Saul heard, told that David had come to Keilah, Saul thought, God has delivered him into my hands, for he shut himself in by entering a town with gates and bars. So it was obviously a gated town, and David is inside it, and Saul thinks now he can make a successful assault on the town and kill David. Saul summoned all the troops for war to go down to Keilah and besiege David and his men. When David learned that Saul was planning to harm him, he told the police Aviatar to bring the ephod forward. And David said, O Lord God of Israel, your servant has heard that Saul intends to come to Keilah and destroy the town because of me. Will the citizens of Keilah deliver me into his hands? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will. David continued, will the citizens of Keilah deliver me and my men into Saul's hands? Because remember, he's just saved them. And the Lord, who is somewhat cynical about human nature, answered, they will. So David and his men, about 600 in number, so he's grown a couple hundred from his initial, left Keilah at once and moved about wherever they could. And when Saul was told that David had gotten away from Keilah, he did not set out. Now you realize how much information and spying and running back and forth is going on in this story. It's quite remarkable because also the distances are not so great. This is how information is getting passed. I mean, it's all got to be word of mouth. There's no other way to pass information other than, you know, than fires and other signals at a distance. No. Okay, so let's go one a little bit more. David was staying in the strongholds of the wilderness of Judah, and he stayed in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. Saul searched for him constantly, but God did not deliver him into his hands. David was once at Choresh in the wilderness of Ziph when David learned that Saul had come out to seek his life. And Saul's son Jonathan came to David at Choresh and encouraged him in the name of God. He said, do not be afraid. The hand of my father Saul will never touch you. You're going to be king over Israel, and I shall be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this is so. And the two of them entered into a pact before the Lord. David remained in Choresh, and Jonathan went home. Jonathan's read is that Saul recognizes that he's in a losing battle, but also Jonathan believes that he's going to be second to David, and that's actually not going to happen because he's going to die in battle with his father. Yeah.
How did Jonathan find David that Saul couldn't?
Presumably because David's people know to trust Jonathan, so they'll tell Jonathan where he is, but they won't tell Saul's people. Yeah. Another? Yeah. I don't know if it's prophecy or at this point almost common sense. Because he sees, look, it's either going to be Saul or David. He sees that David seems every time to be successful in both eluding Saul and in growing his army. So I guess he thinks that David, you know, he knows the two of them best of anyone. So I assume that he realizes that David is going to be successful in a way that Saul, you know, can't be. Yeah.
It's interesting that Saul didn't make an offensive attack on David's stronghold of his father's tribe and certainly put close spies there. So that
maybe he did. We don't know for sure. But, I mean, there you've got to assume there's a lot going on here that we don't hear about, too. All sorts of misinformation or, you know, later on that happens, actually. With David and Avshalom, that someone is deliberately, Hushai is deliberately planted in Avshalom's camp to give him wrong information. And it works. So none of these are new techniques, after all. And there are techniques that are used, I don't know if I ever mentioned this, that they are known that we don't use anymore that aren't mentioned in the Bible, but like I can't remember the name of it. There's actually, believe it or not, an English word taken from the Greek for it. that the way that they used to convey messages was they would shave a messenger's head, write the message on his head, and when his hair grew back, they would send him off. And then when he got to wherever he got to, he would shave his head and read the message. Which I've done with my daughter at times, but I've never seen it done actually in...
There's actually on the news this morning.
What?
Space
on his head, really? Advertising space? That's great. I love that. What do you know? That's very funny. God. So anyway. Some Ziphites went up to Saul and Gibeah and said, David is hiding among us in the strongholds of Choresh. We can just quickly polish off the chapter. Right. The hill of Chalis, south of Jishimon. So if your majesty has the desire to come down, come down. It'll be our task to deliver him into your majesty's hands. And Saul replied, may you be blessed of the Lord for the compassion you've shown me. Go and prepare further. Look around and learn what places he sets foot and who's seen him there, for I've told he's a very cunning fellow. I've been told. Look around and learn in which of the hiding places he's been hiding. Return to me when you're certain. I'll then go with you. And if he's in the region, I'll search him out among all the clans of Judah. They left at once for Ziph ahead of Saul. David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the Arabah in the south of Yeshimon. When Saul and his men came to search, David was told about it. And he went down to the rocky region and stayed there in the wilderness of Maon. On hearing this, Saul pursued David into the wilderness of Maon. Saul was making his way along one side of the hill, and David and his men were on the other side of the hill. It was that close. Okay. David was trying hard to elude Saul, and Saul and his men were trying to encircle David and his men to capture them. When a messenger came and told Saul, come quickly, for the Philistines have invaded the land. Saul gave up his pursuit of David and went to meet the Philistines. That's why the place came to be called the Rock of Separation. So it's all, I mean, if you can imagine this in a movie, it's really like at the last possible moment when Saul was just about to get him, someone comes in and says, you got to go get the Philistines. Obviously the writer has a great dramatic sense as well as telling us the history. It's giving you the sense that it was touch and go. David was that close to dying. But also it gives you the sense, as always happens in the Torah, when you talk about coincidences that save the anointed, the special one, you have the sense that God is behind it. Right? That's why all of a sudden, you know, each time David has the information that allows him to escape, or just as Saul is about to get him and there's no way to get out of it, all of a sudden, Philistines are coming. But God's hand in the story, because the story grows more and more realistic, God's hand grows less and less. And it's much more of a human story than the stories that we've studied so far in the Torah, which are have much more of God's intervention. Here, God's intervention, if it exists, is very subtle and not overwhelming. Yeah.
I have a question. I think I missed that chapter 21, verse 11.
The Achish of God is a Philistine, yes. He's the Philistine king. He's the Philistine king, yep. Yes. That's why when Jonathan and Saul die, the first line of the eulogy is Al Tagidu Begat, don't tell it in Gat. In other words, don't let our enemies know that our heroes have died. So, yeah.
The picture that I get is David had just devastated the Philistines. How is it that they regroup so fast?
Because there are a lot of Philistines. I mean, presumably he defeated one part of the Philistine army in Keilah, but there are other Philistines. Yeah.
Who are these Philistines?
What are they?
They're
a group of seafaring people, as far as we know. We have very little archaeological stuff from them. We have some. Like if you look up Philistine images on the, you know, in the computer, you'll get some bronze carvings and other stuff from the Philistines, but they weren't. The problem is, if a people is not literate, it's very hard to know, like the Etruscans. You know, we know a lot more about the Romans than the Etruscans, not only because they lived much longer, because the Etruscans just didn't leave inscriptions to the extent that more literate peoples did. So we know a lot about ancient Egypt because they had royal records, but we don't have so much from the Philistines, so we don't know. I'm sure they had a religion. Everyone had a religion. But I don't know, I mean, I can't tell you very much about it. I can't. Other people may be able to tell you more. But they were idolaters like everybody, you know? Everybody was an idolater. Even, I mean, you know, the And it's funny, in this week's Parsha, for example, how much the Jewish tradition tries to minimize the idolatry that existed in the Torah. So it says, remember Rachel runs away with Laban's idols. Mm-hmm. And why does she run away with Laban's idols? So that everybody says the reason she runs away with Laban's idols is obviously because she doesn't want him to worship them. Not because she wanted them, God forbid. And then it says, Jacob buried the idols at the terebinth, which means this big tree. I don't remember what the terebinth, but it says exactly where he buries the idols. So why do they tell you where he buried the idols? Well, that's the natural thing is to say, okay, this is a holy site. There are all these gods buried there. But I was just reading, actually, I think on the Bar-Ilan website, a commentary on this, and the professor says it's obvious why it tells you that Jacob buried the idols there, so that if someone should dig it up, they should understand this is not a sacred site. This is a place where hated idols were buried by our forefather Jacob. So, you know, the Israelites, the conquest of idol worship was a very slow process, which is why the prophets are always yelling at the Israelites not to worship idols, because they're always doing it. Yeah.
But the idols were made from gold.
Yes.
So the value could be...
There's value to... Well, yeah, but most of them were made from stone. Most were. Most were made from stone. Yeah. Did the Palestinians now live in Gaza then? I think that it is virtually impossible to have any idea over the years and populations that have traveled all over the world whether there's a continuous line from anyone who lives there now to then. There's just not a continuous history, so who knows? But not only that, but it depends how reliable the history of the Bible is, because if the Bible is reliable, basically the Philistines disappeared from history, you know, and the Israelites took over the land. So, what's that?
The word philologically is the consonants are the same.
Yeah, but so what? I mean, the Roman, Palestine is a Roman word. It's a Latin word. They could have easily taken it from what they thought of as the native inhabitants of the land. You know, philology is a tricky guide over thousands and thousands of years. So the answer is that nobody knows the answer to that. And even more, what I would say is that the question is actually completely irrelevant. This game of who has the right because of who has the history has absolutely nothing to do with the way you get a settlement in the modern world. Because it doesn't matter. The only person who wins that game is you win it for your own side. You're not going to convince the other side that you have a history, therefore we have a right to this land. You have to negotiate in the real modern world. So whether they were or they weren't, I think it's an argument that makes people who make the argument feel good, but has no real world consequences. You know, no, you're not going to get the Palestinians to all of a sudden stand up and go, oh my God, you're right, we weren't here. Go ahead, take the land. I don't know what I was thinking. If only I had read this book of history, I never would have started this in the first place. My bad, you know. Yeah. It's a great question. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Other than people identifying him as David, or people heard that David is coming and then this guy comes, or that there were people in different places who had seen him in other places, you know, otherwise there would be no way to know. But the same thing is true, after all, in America until the last 100 years. I mean, how did people know, you know, that the candidate was the candidate when he stood up and started to say, I'm whoever, you know? You can't know for sure, which is would allow imposters presumably freer reign than they have today. Right, exactly. Yeah, but I guess there were enough people who knew that it was not plausible. Okay, two more quick ones and then we're done. Yeah.
Why is this place called the Rock of Separation?
Because that's where they separated David and Saul. That's all. Yeah. Although It's a sort of weak etymology. So the possibility always exists that the rock was already called that, and then the story, you know, was attributed to the rock as opposed to vice versa.
It must have taken Jonathan a lot of conviction to go to David and sort of betray his father.
Yeah.
Do you think he felt that he'll have a role of power with David, whereas with
it seems that way. It seems that way. It seems, first of all, that he liked David more than he liked his father in some ways, which is not, I mean, look, that's not unusual. It's not unusual. And also, I think maybe he just thought that David was the one, yeah, it was better, stronger, whatever the...
But knowing Saul and his temperament, do you think he ever felt that he would ever succeed his father, whereas with David?
I don't know. I know that his father made a half-hearted attempt to try to kill him, so he can't feel very secure at home. But I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it seems as though Jonathan is, in some ways, the most admirable character in this story. So you hate to think cynically that he was backing David just so he could get power. It doesn't seem like that's who he is, but very hard to know. Very hard to know. I will tell you this, though. I just read, there's an article in a scholarly journal called Vetus Testamentum that talks about the word ahava, love, and the way it's used in the Jonathan David story in particular, but in general. And there's more to it, and I'll talk more about it as the occasion arises. But it says, nikshara, which is the word that is used in one place to talk about how Jonathan and David's souls are entwined, is also a word that's sometimes used for political conspiracies. Which, and what it attributes to is not Jonathan, but that David is, you know, that's his, it says that it sort of, it reinforces the idea that David's connection to Jonathan is at least in large measure because he knows that. Although I just want to also say that, you know, it doesn't make ambition bad if David could also have an affection for Jonathan and think that he's good for him. It doesn't mean that he's cynically using this guy that he has no regard for. I mean, human emotions are too complicated to put somebody in just one box. And David certainly seems capable of a vast range of emotions. Whether he's capable of love, though, is an interesting question. We can't answer that yet.
Aside from himself.
Aside from himself, yes.